content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article today is UK Prime Minister condemns suspected arson attack on mosque in English coastal town. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer on Monday condemned a suspected arson attack on a mosque in an English coastal town which police were investigating as a hate crime. No one was injured. The fire on Saturday night came 2 days after two men were killed when a knife-wielding assailant attacked their synagogue in Manchester on the holiest day of the Jewish year, in what authorities have called a terrorist assault. One of the victims was accidentally shot by an armed officer as he and the other congregants barricaded the synagogue to block the attacker from entering. Starmer's spokesperson said that the Prime Minister was, quote, appalled by the arson attack in Peacehaven, end quote. As the Home Secretary said, attacks against British Muslims are attacks against all Britons and this country itself, the spokesperson said, adding that anti-Muslim hatred has no place in Britain. Emergency services responded to reports of a fire at the Peacehaven Mosque around 9:45 p.m. The front entrance of the mosque and a vehicle parked outside were damaged, but no one was injured, according to Sussex Police. Footage from the incident released by police shows two balaclava-clad people approach the front door of the mosque before spraying accelerant on the entrance and igniting a fire. Detective Inspector Gavin Patch said police were treating the fire as arson with intent to endanger life. Evidence from the scene suggests it was started deliberately, according to East Sussex Fire and Rescue Service. Detectives on Monday were hunting for two suspects. This was an appalling and reckless attack, which we know will have left many people feeling less safe, Patch said. There has been an increased police presence at the scene and other places of worship across Sussex, a region in southeastern England, to provide reassurance, Sussex Police said. It said the incident isn't currently being treated as terror-related. Political and religious leaders condemned the attack. Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood said the attack was deeply concerning and urged people to stand united. This hateful act does not represent our community or our town, a spokesperson for Peacehaven Mosque said. Peacehaven has always been a place of kindness, respect, and mutual support, and we will continue to embody those values. Phil Rosenberg, president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, also condemned the attack, adding that every faith community has the right to worship free from fear. The attacks come amid high tensions over the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations have been held regularly across the UK since the start of Israel's military offensive in Gaza. The protests have been overwhelmingly peaceful, but some people say they have allowed anti-Semitism to spread. Some Jews say they feel threatened by chants such as, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." A handful of pro-Palestinian protesters have been arrested for supporting Hamas, which is banned in the UK. On Saturday, about 1,000 people gathered in Trafalgar Square to protest against the banning of Palestine Action, a direct action group that has vandalized British military planes and targeted sites with links to the Israel military. It has been labeled a terrorist organization by the government, making support for the group illegal. A day later, hundreds of people waving Israeli and British flags rallied in London and Manchester to mark nearly 2 years since the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7th of 2023, demand the hostages' release, and mourn the victims of Thursday's synagogue attack. Our second article is an opinion piece. The Gaza war hasn't changed interfaith relations one bit. That's a bad thing. This is written by Paul O'Donnell for Religion News Service. 2 years of war in the Middle East has changed how Americans feel about Israel, surveys say, and how American Jews in particular feel about Israel's leadership. It has changed how students feel on university campuses and those campuses' relationships with the federal government. It stands to reason that the war will also have changed how American Jews, Muslims, and Christians feel about each other. In reality, though, how the events of October 7th of 2023 and the Gaza conflict changed interfaith relations in America can be summed up in three words: not at all. But that is not a good thing. The events of October 7th and the ensuing bloodshed have accelerated a troubling decades-old trend in interfaith engagement, in which alliances are formed between people of different faiths who agree on politics and whose politics shape the various views of the God they worship. That is what happens when politics becomes the new religion, as it has for almost everyone in America. The fights people used to have about who we could or should marry, who we could count as friends, and what our futures depended on used to be largely faith-fueled fights. They were animated by the language of good and evil, and the right answers were defined along religious lines. Now those fights, and the language that accompanies them, are driven more by political ideologies. Religion simply supplies convenient footnotes for those who want them, on whatever side of the issue they happen to stand. To put it more bluntly, for most Americans, religion is politics in drag. Were it otherwise, Americans would see differences in faith as wedge issues when it comes to choosing life partners or how we see the future. But increasingly, that is not the case. Those issues are now much more a function of political differences and party affiliation than spiritual identity or denominational affiliation. The trend is demonstrated by the fact that more than 80% of currently married couples in the U.S. vote along the same party lines, while an almost equal percentage are in mixed faith families. 2 decades ago, those percentages were closer to being the reverse. Were it otherwise, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, an evangelical Christian pastor, would not be an ally of Israel's religious Zionist party leaders such as Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir. That they are such allies is possible because the politics they share speaks with greater force than the faith they do not. At the other end of the political spectrum, similar alliances exist between radically secular anti-Zionist Jewish organizations and faith-based Christian groups, whose anti-Zionism is driven by their understanding of how God calls them to be in the world. The rejection of Zionism has even led some Hasidic groups to be allied with the most virulently anti-Israel Palestinian groups. In all of these cases, the participants' understanding of faith are not only different, but often mutually exclusive, and yet they forge alliances around political issues with no effort or theological struggle. By whatever name they call their God or understand God's will, they are certain that the God upon whom they call shares their political goals, and because of that, all meaningful religious difference is swept away. This state of affairs is bad for religion and bad for politics, and it robs us of the rich and desperately needed value of more serious interfaith relations. Don't get me wrong, any time people can reach across boundaries, religious, political, or otherwise, without feeling that they have given up their integrity, we are all better off. But when the reaching across one set of fanatically held boundaries from the past is done only to instantiate another equally hard-edged ideology, nothing gets better. One could argue that things actually get worse as we congratulate ourselves for building bold and boundary-crossing relationships, ignoring the fact that we only cross those boundaries to congratulate one another on how right we are because we are really the same and, quote, God is with us, end quote. That the war has made all this worse is not at all surprising. When people feel attacked, they typically rely on three responses, fight, flight, or freeze. The fighting is obvious and yet to be truly resolved. The flight into ideological silos is equally clear, as is the freezing. Our ability to create relationship depends less on agreement and more on allowing ourselves to see and recognize the full dignity of those with whom we agree, with whom we disagree. That is where a more profound interfaith encounter could play a new and constructive role. Imagine if people of different faiths gathered not to confirm that their different gods share the same politics, but to explore the ways their infinitely wise traditions have room for multiple politics and competing political views. Imagine people of different faiths gathering not to proclaim uniform political conclusions based on different religious footnotes, but instead to explore how people of different faiths could lead an interfaith movement for better, healthier, and more constructive interpolitical engagement. Imagine if interfaith engagement turned from alliance building among people who worship differently because ultimately we all are all the same, as it too often goes now, to interfaith engagement as an opportunity to deepen genuine relationships with those who are genuinely different. None of us will be able to do that with everybody, nor in all candor should we. But we all could do it more and more often, and in doing so, interfaith engagement could renew itself in ways that could help heal the entire world. And the views expressed in this commentary do not necessarily represent those of the Religion News Service. For our third story, Harut Bastjian, a Christian muralist, found his calling painting mosque domes. And this was written by Ula Kuziz. In the Lebanese countryside where church bells and calls to prayer echo together, Harut Bastjian grew up walking to afternoon mass with his mom, then crossing the street to spend hours with friends at a mosque. I used to play with my matchbox cars on the mosque's carpet frames, said Bastjian, who now lives in Dearborn, Michigan. I somehow grew up in the part of Lebanon during the war where Christians and Muslims lived in harmony. Bastjian's interfaith upbringing has continued to inspire and motivate his work as an artist. An Armenian Christian, he has helped restore several churches, including a landmark 19th century Roman church and an 18th century Armenian monastery in Lebanon. But the muralist has come to be known mostly for the nearly 50 mosque domes he has painted, including in the U.S., weaving together traditional arabesque patterns, natural motifs, and elegant Arabic calligraphy, Bastagian's work graces dozens of grand mosques, such as Mohammed Al-Amin Mosque, Lebanon's largest, Nigeria's Ilorin Mosque, and the Islamic Association of Greater Detroit. A new exhibition at the Arab American National Museum in Michigan celebrates these domes and offers visitors an intimate look at Bastagian's large-scale designs through original panels and photographic displays. It's the pride of the community that we are in America, and we brought our culture. Our art is here, and we're putting it in a nice display, Bastagian said. The best place to put your history is the museum or the house of worship where all the people come together. The artist has not always worked in sacred places. For years, after studying interior design in college, he painted murals for palaces and mansions owned by Middle Eastern mafias and politicians. Now, he said, he is lucky his work is fulfilling. I am doing something for the house of God, not somebody's house, Bastagian said. Father Rant Kevorkian was among dozens of attendees at the opening night for Bastagian's exhibition on September 25th. Kevorkian, the pastor of St. Sarkis Armenian Apostolic Church in Dearborn, first saw Bastagian's work nearly 15 years ago at the Islamic Center of America, one of the largest mosques in the country, which sits adjacent to Kevorkian's church. They met many years later when Bastagian moved to Dearborn and came to Kevorkian's church for Sunday Mass. Since then, the two Armenian men have become good friends. It's his passion. It's a God-given gift that he wants to give back to God. And that's how I see it, Kevorkian said, adding that Bastagian is designing a cross for the church. Bastagian conceives each project from the ground level where worshipers will view the art. He said it sometimes takes months to come up with a design that blends his own artistic touch with traditional styles appropriate for a particular sect and ethnic group. Islamic art avoids physical representation of animated beings in places of worship. Instead, Muslim artists across ethnic backgrounds developed elaborate geometric designs, ornamental Arabic calligraphy, and natural motifs. Bastagian said those elements together are meant to remind worshipers of the divine. God created this world filled with beauty and harmony, and calligraphy and floral representation can connect a person with God, said Zulfikar Ali Shah, director of religious affairs at the Islamic Association of Greater Detroit. So when you enter a mosque, the coloring scheme, the carpet, the woodwork, the calligraphy, all of them take you away and you transcend the concerns of the material world. The Art of Spiritual Enlightenment exhibition, on display until December, traces Bastagian's artistic process and showcases the sometimes risky task of painting mosque domes as high as 150 feet. Mark Mulder, a curator at the museum who worked with Bastagian over the summer to create the displays, said he hopes people engage with the exhibition and then apply something that they take to their life. For Mulder, the exhibition is a lesson in compassion. It's a lesson in caring. But it's also that you don't have to belong to a group to learn about them, to understand them, and to care about them and to produce things for them, Maldar said. Next, Arthur Waskow, pioneering social justice rabbi, dies. This was written by Yonat Shimron. Rabbi Arthur Waskow, an iconic social justice activist considered the forefather of post-war American Jewish progressivism, died on October 20th, 1 week after celebrating his 92nd birthday. Waskow, who since 1983 led the Shalom Center in Philadelphia, was active in many of the leading social causes of the late 20th century, starting with nuclear disarmament, civil rights, environmental justice, and many more. He earned a reputation as a radical on the forefront of movements for equality and justice. With his long white beard and embroidered yarmulkes, he resembled a Hebrew Jewish prophet. He never worked as a pulpit rabbi. He was really everywhere in terms of progressive Jewish activism from the 1960s until literally last year, said Shaul Magid, visiting professor of modern Jewish studies at Harvard Divinity School. Waskow's reputation for peacemaking prompted the Philadelphia chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations to issue a statement Tuesday, calling him a steadfast friend, partner, and moral voice for justice. Waskow was born and grew up in Baltimore, where his father was a labor organizer and his mother helped register black people to vote. The civil rights movement of the 1960s shaped him profoundly. In the summer of 1966, he was a founding member of Jews for Urban Justice in Washington, which became a part of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People's Campaign. The group's breakout social action occurred on the eve of Yom Kippur that year, when Waskow and others protested a Washington synagogue that included congregants who refused to rent real estate to blacks. They used Kol Nidri, the Yom Kippur evening prayer, to express their outrage after the rabbi of the synagogue refused to condemn the landlords. By then, Waskow had already been a seasoned activist working on nuclear disarmament and at the Peace Research Institute in Washington. After that 1966 action, however, he became more focused on Jewish issues. He was perhaps best known for writing The Freedom Seder, a new Haggadah for Passover, a reinterpretation of the classic retelling of the Exodus story of the Israelites' liberation from Egyptian slavery. He was on his way to a Seder, or Passover meal, a week after King's assassination on April 4, 1968, when he came across a Jeep with a machine gun and soldiers on the street in Washington, quelling a riot. My kishkis, or gut, began to say, "This is Pharaoh's army on the street," he told Religion News Service at the time. "I was shaken. I went away totally changed." Later that year, he began writing the Freedom Seder, weaving together the traditional liturgy alongside of texts by King, Henry David Thoreau, Mahatma Gandhi, and others. "The reason I'm a rabbi now is because of the Freedom Seder," said Waskow, who was ordained in 1995, 26 years after the Freedom Seder was published. "It was writing me as much as I was writing it. I was possessed." He also wrote several other books, including The Bush is Burning in 1971, God Wrestling, 1978, Seasons of Our Joy in 1990, and Dancing in God's Earthquake, 2020. "He was a real pioneer," said Susanna Heschel, professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College, who knew him for years. "He saw ways in which the Bible was a way to bring people together, not to divide." There were not a lot of people then interested in that kind of interfaith work, especially not in left-wing circles. Waskow was ordained privately at the age of 62 by four rabbis, including Zalman Schachter Shalomi, the founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement, with which Waskow was involved in the early days. But he defied any denominational affiliation. He taught at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College outside Philadelphia and at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute for Religion, a Reform Movement seminary, where he taught what is considered the first course on eco-Judaism. "He was a model of how to be a human being," said Heschel. "It didn't matter if you agreed with him politically or religiously. He would still be your friend. He was full of life and enthusiasm." A funeral for Waskow was held at Mishkan Shalom in Philadelphia. Next, history will be made when King Charles III prays with Pope Leo XIV. A future may be as well. This was written by Catherine Pepinster. When King Charles III lands in Rome for an official state visit with Pope Leo XIV, you can expect all the pomp that accompanies such an occasion. But the meeting will also include a historic moment of some circumstance when Charles publicly prays with Leo in an ecumenical service in the Sistine Chapel. The historical significance stems from the king's role as supreme governor of the Church of England, the church founded by Henry VIII in the 16th century, when he fell out with the Roman Catholic Church over his desire for his marriage to Catherine of Aragon to be annulled. Though Charles has visited the Vatican five times, and his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, had official visits with popes going back to Pope John XXIII, it will be the first time in 400 years that a British monarch has prayed with the head of the Catholic Church. The service in the Sistine Chapel will take as its theme the care of creation and church unity. It was first planned for April, but the state visit was canceled due to the ill health of Francis. The papacies and monarch's shared interest in dialogue between religions is also reflected in the Sistine Chapel service. The Vatican has two departments that focus on dialogue, one for promoting Christian unity and the other for interreligious dialogue. The ecumenical service in the Sistine Chapel will be jointly led by Pope Leo and the Archbishop of York, Stephen Cottrell, and will also feature the children of the choir of His Majesty's Chapel Royal and the choir of St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle, both Anglican choirs from royal households, accompanied by the Sistine Chapel Choir. Holding the service in the Basilica says much in itself about the two churches' renewed friendship. Together with its adjoining Benedictine Abbey, the building has a long pre-Reformation tradition of being associated with the English crown. I did have to edit that last article for time because we have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religious News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832.